We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with Frances Larson, talking to her by phone in, do you live in Durham, England, or nearby, Fran?
Yeah, that's right, in Durham, in the northeast of England.
And the phone system sounds like it's just working perfectly for us today. I'm so pleased because we have very violent weather here in the Midwest. You just heard that we have blizzard warnings out in the Midwest part of the U.S., Illinois and Indiana, 18 degrees outside with winds 20 to 30 miles per hour. So how is it in England?
Well, we've had some bad snow here as well, but you guys are probably more prepared for it than we are here. It tends to stop the whole country and nothing moves. But it's melting away now, so, you know, hopefully we'll get going again here.
We're talking with Frances Larson today, who has a PhD from Cambridge and is an historian.
Oxford.
I've been reading about, you've been reading your book about all these people from that other school, sorry.
Yeah.
From Oxford. And she is an anthropologist and a historian. And her most recent book is called An Infinity of Things, How Sir Henry Welcome Collected the World. It's printed by Oxford University Press. And it's about this fascinating character, Henry Welcome. Let's just start right in. Give our listeners his when he lived. What were his dates and so forth?
Well, he was born in August 1853 in Almond, Wisconsin, and in a very tiny, tiny settlement. And his family, when he was about 9 or 10, moved to Garden City, Minnesota.
His father was an Adventist minister, you mentioned.
That's right, yeah. His father was really, unfortunately, a failed farmer who was a very devout man. Both his parents were very devout. And his father became an itinerant minister with the Second Adventists. So he really grew up in very poor circumstances where life was very tough.
In Wisconsin. And he lived a very long time.
Yep, he died in London. He actually died in the States, but he'd become a British citizen and lived in London almost his entire life from his mid-20s onwards. He died in 1936.
He had become a British citizen, your book tells us, in 1910, mm-hmm. And that was very important to him.
Yeah, he had an interesting relationship with America and the UK. He came to the UK in his mid to late 20s to start up in business. He was very determined to be a successful businessman. He was trained as a pharmacist, and he saw an opportunity in the pharmaceuticals industry in the UK. But he was very proud of his American roots and his early collection. He was a museum collector his whole life. And his early collection was very much focused on Native American artifacts and his earlier life in the US. And he was very proud of those roots and enjoyed showing off, really, to his British friends who thought it was all terribly exotic and exciting. And he returned to America frequently throughout his life. So although he did become a British citizen, he was still very focused on his American family and his American roots.
And you tell the story in your wonderful book about how he first recounted being interested in collecting things, chipped stone that was a tool of some sort from Wisconsin.
Yeah, he later claimed, I mean, this was when he was in his 70s, so there may have been a little bit of romantic nostalgia about it. By that time, he had an enormous museum collection, which he was famous for. But he remembered then that his first object lesson, as he called it, had come when he was 4 years old, and he'd picked up a chipped stone from outside the log cabin where he'd grown up, and showed it to his father, and his father had explained to him that this apparently extremely simple and primitive chipped piece of stone had been more important to the Neolithic people who'd made it than the modern telegraph wires and railway lines that were sprouting up all over the United States of America. So he claimed that that thought that something so simple could be so vital to someone's livelihood and well-being had later inspired his ongoing interest in the history of humanity and the history of health and well-being.
Well, let's just jump right in and talk also about his collection, because as you mentioned, that is what he was most famous for, and that's what your book really is a biography of, his whole enterprise of spending his life collecting this amazing amount of things and the quality of things. But I suppose we have to say where he got the money and the time to be able to do this. So let me summarize a couple things. The Burroughs Wellcome Company became this huge pharmaceutical international company began with these two Americans who went to England and started selling pharmaceuticals there. Excuse me. And established this company. You might say a few words about that.
Yeah, these were two young, very ambitious young American men who'd met at Pharmaceuticals College in Philadelphia in the late 1870s. And the elder one was Silas Burroughs. And he was a very wealthy young American who was incredibly ambitious. And he, like Wellcome, they both worked for big pharmaceuticals companies in the United States. And Burroughs decided in 1878 to move to London, where he would sell the same products made by the same American firm, but to a new British market. And he persuaded his friend Wellcome to join him. Wellcome was working in New York for another big pharmaceuticals company. So they set up together in London in 1880. And they were a brilliant, although slightly flawed, partnership.
But it became seriously flawed later on. Yes,
it did. It really ended very badly. But initially they were brilliant together because Wellcome was very meticulous and thorough and organized. And Burroughs was very charismatic and ambitious and had a real flair for meeting people and making contacts. So their business, gradually at first, but by the late 1880s and early 1890s, they had really started to make quite a lot of money and had started expanding overseas and making their own drugs. And within a decade, really, they were free of their American agents and had started producing their own medicines and drugs and were extremely successful.
And the amount of money that they made very young in their 30s was really phenomenal, but not unlike what other entrepreneurs were doing in that growing industrial time.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, they really transformed the market in pharmaceuticals at a time when things were really undergoing massive change technologically. Just a decade or so before, people had been mixing medicines on their own using pestles and mortars and complicated solutions and recipes. And what Burroughs and Wellcome did was to introduce these pre-manufactured tablets and pills that were incredibly convenient and easy to administer and really revolutionized the way people looked after themselves. They were so much more compact and reliable than previous rather cumbersome medicines. So they really hit the European market at a very exciting time for the pharmaceuticals industry.
Let me just go very quickly through a little bit of the history that you tell in good detail in your book. But Burroughs died at age 49, and that left Wellcome completely in charge.
Yeah, Burroughs died very young of bronchitis and associated complications in 1895. And by that time, they'd been in partnership for 15 years, and they really hated each other. I mean, that's not too strong a word. They only corresponded through their lawyers. Their differences in character had really become very corrosive, and they had numerous times tried to dissolve the partnership but couldn't agree on terms. So when Burroughs died so prematurely, Wellcome was eventually able to take sole ownership of the company, and that really freed him to run the company the way he wanted to. And also, by that time, he was extremely wealthy, and he began to devote more time to his other interests.
And of course, as your book describes, an infinity of things, how Sir Henry Wellcome collected the world. He was knighted later in his life by the English government, but let's talk about this amazing collection, and I just don't know where to start. And that was the problem, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was certainly the problem for me studying it. I mean, anyone who studies it is faced with the same problems, really, that Wellcome was, because there was just so much stuff. I mean, really, more than a million items, thousands upon thousands, hundreds of thousands of packing cases filled with things.
And he hired people to do this collecting for him eventually all over the world. And back in England, where all this stuff was sent, you report that one time, on one day, there were 7 tons of material delivered.
Can't
even imagine it.
It boggles the mind. It really does. I mean, Wellcome staff, after he died, took to measuring the collection by the ton. So there were 2.5 tons of swords and 3.5 tons of guns and shields, 5 tons of photograph albums. I mean, it really was a collection of extraordinary proportions that filled vast warehouses throughout London and throughout the world, because Burroughs Wellcome, the company, had depots all over the world, and they were often filled with Wellcome's objects that his staff had bought for him. So it really did become a big business in a way.
You point out that collecting for Sir Henry became a way of life, but he began by a rather modest goal of the history and science of healing. You know, he was in pharmaceuticals and concerned with that, and so he kind of wanted to collect these things as a museum to learn from them, but just to have to do with healing at first, but then it just broadened.
Yeah, that's the thing. He it's very hard to trace the real beginnings. I mean, he had that story about when he was 4 years old, and it does seem that he just had an affinity for things, and he just picked things up his whole life. From when he was a boy, he was constantly buying little curiosities and keeping things. But when he was a student of pharmacy, he did start buying things related to the history of medicine and the history of science, really as an aid to his study, to try and learn more about the pharmaceuticals industry. And when, in his mid-40s, after Burroughs had died, that's when he really decided to transform this operation from a private hobby into a much more grand undertaking. And in the 1890s, he started employing people to buy things, manuscripts and books related to the history of science, from all over the world, but also scientific equipment and relics related to famous scientists and all kinds of things related to nursing and chemistry and physics. So his kind of stated aim was to produce a museum of the history of human health. But the truth was he couldn't resist all sorts of things of all different kinds, and he was always very interested in other cultures and always collected artifacts related to the Native American cultures, the African cultures and Asian, and archaeological artifacts as well. So really, he found it very hard to turn anything down in the end.
You mentioned in your book that he really believed philosophically somehow, and apparently this was typical of his time, that in the individual objects was not only, it was the data on which science depended, and they were valuable in themselves. They were facts.
Yeah, that's very true, and I think that's really key to understanding Wellcome's attitude to objects, which was so kind of acquisitive. And I think there was a general belief around the turn of the 20th century that objects were data in a very uncomplicated way. We're now very used to thinking, or in the museum profession, we're very used to thinking of objects as being very ambiguous things, that an artifact can tell many different stories about the person who made it, about the person who later bought it, about the museum's own agenda, perhaps the exhibition that it's in. But 100 years ago, there was this idea that objects were just straightforward facts, and if you had objects, then you had knowledge, and that was knowledge that you could just display. It would display your status, your intellectual achievements. So I think there was this kind of explains Wellcome's attitude to acquiring things, that he really saw it as research. And of course, museums are research institutions. But he was very much, once he had the things and he knew that they were safe in his warehouses, he had that kind of feeling that then the ideas were his too, and the information about the world was his as well. So he was kind of trying to contain the world and own it, purportedly for other people's benefit, although he didn't find it very easy to share his things with other people.
I want to talk about some of the values that we see in Sir Henry Wellcome from the way he operated. That's a fascinating part of your book. Let me remind listeners, this is a live call-in show, and listeners not only in the Champaign-Urbana area in mid-Illinois and Indiana can call in at a local number, 217-333-9455, but also folks listening on the Internet may call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. So again, if it's a long-distance call to Urbana, Illinois, use the 800 number, 222-9455. If you're in the 217 area code, 333-9455. Happy to have you ask questions or make comments with our author. We're talking with Frances Larson. We're talking with her from her home in Durham, England, about her new book, An Infinity of Things, How Sir Henry Wellcome, that's spelled Wellcome, Collected the World. Sir Henry Wellcome of Burroughs Wellcome Pharmaceuticals and his amazing collection that can be seen now in museums all over the world, as well as in England. Fran, when you began this study, you had already published one book about another museum with a co-author who was your, I guess, academic advisor at Oxford?
Yes, that's absolutely right, yes.
That was Knowing Things, Exploring the Collections at the Pitt Rivers Museum. That also was an Oxford University Press book that came out in 2007. And here you have your second book, and I understand you're working diligently on a third. Do you want to tell us at least the title of that one?
Well, it doesn't have a set title at the moment. It's in quite early stages. I've just been commissioned to write it. It's a rather shocking subject matter, but I think it's also quite an important one. And the preliminary title is Headhunters, because it's about the way that Western cultures have studied and displayed the human head and scientific collections of human skulls and all sorts of aspects of the history of how we, in our own culture, have displayed and thought about the human head.
So you've been commissioned to write that, and will that just be in English? Will that be published by an English publisher or an American? Or
it's going to be published in the UK by Portobello, and it's going to be published in North America by Norton.
Norton's, okay, great.
Yeah.
And
you
have a hoped-for date?
Yes, hopefully I'll be submitting the manuscript at the end of next year, and which means that, fingers crossed, it should be out in 2012.
Now, you seem to be able to keep to projected dates. Why could Sir Henry not do that?
Well, I think because he was a perfectionist, and he was almost too organized. I know that sounds counterintuitive, but he was so good at managing people and setting systems in place to acquire these extraordinary objects that he was interested in, that the system almost took him over, and he almost became just one part of a much bigger process in which there were lots of people traveling, attending auction sales, constantly acquiring things for him. And he also was a terrible perfectionist. I mean, he just wanted, although he was happy to let other people buy things for him, when it came to interpreting those things and exhibiting them and presenting them to the people who visited his museum, he was very controlling, and he wanted to do that himself and be completely in control of the message of the museum. So those two things, of course, didn't work very well together, because on the one hand he had a huge staff of people whose daily job it was to just buy things for him, and so all these things were piling up literally to the ceilings, to the rafters of these warehouses in London.
Often unpacked.
In the late 1920s, when he'd been collecting for about 30 years, they started trying to go through his warehouses, which was an enormous job. And they found cases that had been sent from auction houses like Sotheby's and Christie's in London that hadn't been opened since the day they arrived in the warehouse. The things inside had never been seen, and they'd been just shut up and packed away in the corner of a massive warehouse for 20 years or 25 years. So it really was stifling. It really was very difficult to penetrate the collection by that time.
You mentioned his character. I made a note of some of the words you used to describe him in various chapters, such as he was painfully vigilant. he showed dogged earnestness. As you already just pointed out, very organized. There were some sorts of people he could work well with, other people he just couldn't get along with, and you point out in one of your chapters, particularly women that he would hire to do some of his collecting, he often had a very patronizing attitude toward, and wouldn't trust them nearly as much as he trusted some of his men buyers.
Yes, I think that is the case, but one also has to remember that was very common at the time. Women had really an uphill struggle when it came to having any kind of professional life at all. And there were all sorts of prejudices and barriers against them in all kinds of business and professional situations, including academia. So although there is definitely evidence that Welcomed was more patronizing towards women and didn't give them the free rein that he gave his male collectors, I think the women themselves would probably have admitted that that would have been the case wherever they had worked. So it's, you know, one has to kind of be cautious about judging him personally on that, because it was just the atmosphere of the times as well. But it is very striking to read now that about some of the letters to his women collectors, who were very diligent and brilliant and adventurous and accomplished, often fluent in many different languages, well-traveled, very experienced with professional qualifications, often more impressive than some of the men who worked for Welcome. And yet they constantly faced this kind of patronizing rules that were enforced on them, that they couldn't have as much freedom or financial freedom, and they had to report back more frequently. So it was definitely, you know, a tough environment for female academics at the turn of the last century.
Well, let me ask you a personal question. You, as a female academic in this new century, when you were at Oxford working on your doctorate as an anthropologist and historian and working with your advisor, was it unusual that you would be given that you were a co-author of this book that came out? Was that before your dissertation had even been accepted, your first book?
Yes, I started on that project while my dissertation was being examined. So it had been handed in and finished in that sense, but I was still waiting to be examined. I had a very good working relationship with my advisor at Oxford, who is an incredibly enthusiastic and imaginative academic who is not at all threatened by other people's having good ideas and wanting to do their own thing. So I was lucky from that point of view. I think as in anything, in terms of being a woman working in a university, it depends on the characters of the people involved. And I think probably wherever you work, there are going to be some people who have more traditional views than other people who don't have any you know, hesitation or prejudices at all. So I was lucky that I got on so well with my advisor, and we had a very productive professional relationship after I'd handed in my thesis.
Now, it looks like your advisory committee for your doctorate was, am I correct, 6 men and 1 woman?
No. In fact, in Oxford, it's quite a different
system. Okay.
It's a different system. We only have 2 examiners who give you a viva, you know, the interview examination on your thesis. Mine were both very lovely men who it was a great honor.
Well, I was just reading your list in your acknowledgments, and maybe I was reading too much into it, obviously, of the first people, the list of people you thanked early on.
Oh, well, I did. I mean, I have worked with, you know, with various colleagues, both at the Wellcome Trust in London and in Oxford. So it may be, yes, that was more of an acknowledging more informal relationship.
I see. And what is the situation for young women academics in England these days? Were there as many women in your classes as men?
Yes, there absolutely were. I mean, I should imagine that there isn't much difference between the UK and the USA when it comes to being a woman in academia, and that is personally that I have found no impediments or prejudices at all, and in fact, gender has not been in any sense an issue for me in my career. It's been very much based on individual accomplishments and interests and characters, really.
When I was perhaps imagining another difficulty you might have had, and that is you thanked the Wellcome Trust, the pharmaceutical company trust that Sir Henry set up for support for the publishing of at least of the beautiful color plates that are in the center of your book, the many pages of beautiful plates. Did taking money from the trust in any way keep you from being honest about your assessment of Sir Henry?
Not at all. In fact, the trust were really great in that they didn't get involved at all. It's funny because when I first embarked on my PhD, because this book began as my PhD thesis quite a few years ago now.
How many years ago?
I think I started my PhD in 2000.
Oh, a long time.
And then afterwards I got a job, a different job in a different museum and wrote the first book. So I had a break of about 4 years before I returned to the Wellcome Project.
Uh-huh. But I was reading, you know, you would describe Sir Henry, his unerring greed and his insatiable appetite for collecting, and that he was first and foremost a consumer. And I could just see these trustees saying, do we want this young woman to be taking our money to have to print this book that says this about our founder?
Well, I should clarify that I didn't take the money for the research at all. In fact, when I started on my PhD, I applied to the Wellcome Trust. They do fund history of medicine projects. But because of the way they assign their money, they only give it to people who have a particular master's degree in the history of medicine. So I didn't qualify, and I didn't get any money for my research. And at the time, I was really a bit put out by it because they're incredibly wealthy, and I was studying their founder. But very soon I realized that that was a very good thing because it meant that I was completely independent as a scholar and I could formulate my own opinions and create my own narratives, my own interpretation of their history. And I think this book, so the only money that the Wellcome Trust have contributed was a few hundred pounds towards the illustrations, which was after the text had been finalized.
I see. So so Oxford Press had already finalized the text before that all happened.
Yeah.
Well, let me say a couple words about just the book itself. Since it's a book about objects, I think it's very appropriate that it is itself a wonderful book, just as an object. Wonderfully illustrated. The color plates are just so precise. And how you selected only, 18 of 18 objects to represent in the plates out of the million that he collected, I don't know, but it's a great selection. And the illustrations throughout the rest of the book, although they're black and white, were just so helpful in seeing what was happening in the book. And then the book itself, the design of it and the paper and everything is just such a treasure to have. And I'm pleased that I bought it, and I encourage listeners to look for it. Again, it's called An Infinity of Things, How Sir Henry Wellcome Collected the World by Francis Larson. And, of course, I haven't said yet how well written it is, but I'm happy to say it is. It's fascinating, not only the character and the collection, but the way it's presented. So I'm pleased to be talking to its author. And, of course, it is unusual for WILL to let those of us who interview people call someone in England, but I'm pleased that I can do that once or twice a year, so, or somewhere else in the farther reaches of the world. Let me repeat the numbers for people who are listening who might like to call and join this conversation. 333-9455 if you're in the 217 area code near Champaign-Urbana. Perhaps you're listening also on 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana, as well as WILL 580 AM here on Illinois Public Media. You may also be listening, of course, online at will.illinois.edu/AM. And if you've missed part of this program and would like to hear it at your leisure, at your computer, you, of course, may do that. There's podcasts available at that same website, will.illinois.edu/AM or /keepinthefaith. You can find it either way. We're talking with Fran Larson in England, and you've stayed up pretty late for this. What is it, about 11:30 your time before midnight?
Yes, it is. It's 11:30.
Well, thanks for doing this. Next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking to someone on the East Coast of the United States in Philadelphia. Her name is Joanne Fong, about her move from fashion design to the pulpit. That will be December 19 on Sunday evening from 5 to 6 Central Time here on Keeping the Faith. On December 26, we'll be playing one of our archive programs with philosopher Martha Nussbaum from the University of Chicago. We'll be replaying a program where Don Nolan was interviewing her about her book, Not for Profit, Why Democracies Need the Humanities, talking about the philosophy of education. That's philosopher Martha Nussbaum on December 26th. And January 2nd, I'll be back, and we'll be talking live with Dick Watts from the Bloomington, Illinois area about his book, Hungers of the Heart, Hungers of the Heart, Spirituality and Religion for the 21st Century. And then on January 9th, guest talking about Christian Science. Later in January, Abby Harmon talking about the homeless. So those are some of the programs coming up here on Keeping the Faith. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the objects in this collection. Welcome did not collect things like, say, Rockefeller did and other wealthy industrialists of that time, like fine art. He just wasn't interested in competing or in acquiring those sorts of things. Your book tells us that he was happy to find just plain everyday objects from different cultures. Yes, originally just around the medicine and healing arts, but eventually just cultures everywhere around the world.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. He's unlike Rockefeller and Frick and Morgan and the great American collectors of the late 19th century and early 20th century, he was not interested in spending a lot of money on a very few things and fine art collecting. Instead, he saw himself more as a scientific collector. He kind of aligned himself more with anthropologists and natural historians, and he was interested in documenting everyday practices around the world and creating a resource, really, for researchers who could study particular medical practices or health practices using all kinds of different books and manuscripts and objects and pictures. So he was very much focused on what we might think of as quite mundane things. He did sometimes spend a lot of money on a few things that he thought were very important, but he saw them as important from a historical point of view rather than from an art critical point of view. He was, and the other thing about focusing on the everyday was that he wanted a lot of things that were quite similar because he was interested in the development of design and technology. So he wanted to kind of see how different techniques and designs of medical equipment or laboratory equipment had developed over time. So he often would create series of things, like series of scalpels or series of spears or series of amulets, or because he wanted to kind of piece back together the history of the development of these different designs.
As an example of some of the ordinary objects that he collected when he was 19 and still in the U.S., you report that from the Chicago fire of 1873, he somehow got part of the doorstep of where it started.
Yes, you come across, when you're working in the archives at the Wellcome Trust, which are extraordinary and full of fascinating documents, you come across these strange lists of little inconsequential things, you know, like the corner of a doorstep or some type foundry settings that type out HSW, Wellcome's initials. Later on, he was even buying things like straw dollies and, there's one...
Children's dolls, yeah.
Yeah, children's dolls and prams for children and all sorts of kind of mundane things that didn't seem to have any part in his bigger ambitions to explore the history of medicine. But he just loved things and he just thought that you never knew when something, however small and insignificant it seemed, might play a key part in the history of humanity and the history of design and the history of childhood or health or marriage or death. So he was just very interested in people's relationships with their material world.
And at the other extreme, you mentioned that, for example, his love for books of all kinds, and with unlimited funds, he could buy amazing things. You report that when William Morris's library came for auction at Sotheby's, that he managed to buy through his various agents or himself 485 lots just of that library.
Yeah, he was very interested in great workers of science and history. So he did buy, he was prepared to spend more when an object had been owned by someone very famous. So, for example, he bought Charles Darwin's walking stick and Napoleon Bonaparte's toothbrush and lots of relics relating to great scientists like Joseph Lister and Edward Jenner and Florence Nightingale. So under certain circumstances, when he felt that an object was very important for his story about the history of science and scientific discovery, he was prepared to spend big and buy a lot of more expensive items.
Let's talk a little bit about his personal life. When he was 48, you report in your fourth chapter, he married a 22-year-old woman. Tell us about Queenie.
Yeah, Queenie is a fascinating character. Her life was kind of lived between the lives of these very big and famous men. Her father was a very famous Victorian philanthropist in Britain called Thomas Barnardo, who founded a very well-known set of homes for disadvantaged children, for orphans, in the late Victorian era.
So she came from money herself. She was young, attractive. Why did she fall for a 48-year-old man who'd never married?
Well, that is the big question. She was vivacious and attractive, as you say. She was only 22. He was nearly 50. The theory is, and I should just say that the marriage ended after about 9 years, and Wellcome destroyed nearly all the documents relating to his marriage. So it is a little bit of a guessing game.
Now, they had a son in 1903.
They had a son, and the theory is that Queenie, as she was known, that was her nickname, was in a way trying to escape her rather puritanical and strict family by marrying this very wealthy and well-connected and well-established businessman, Henry Welcome. And initially, it would seem that they were very happy. They traveled a lot. They had a son, as you say, who was born the day after their second wedding anniversary, and they both loved dearly, and they both enjoyed buying things. So they traveled all over Europe and the United States and bought all sorts of things for their house. And but unfortunately, the marriage ended very abruptly and disastrously because Welcome, who was a very proud man and very private, thought that his wife was having an affair. And she always denied this. She always said that she had never had an affair. She always wanted to be reconciled with him. But he would not. He actually never spoke to her again. They were on holiday in Ecuador. And she left because they'd had presumably a terrible argument over this. And she left for New York with friends. And he never spoke to her again. He was very self-reliant and proud and unbending, really, in his personal relationships. And although she implored him to talk to her and take her back, he didn't. So she was not yet 30 and separated from her husband and had to find her way in London. And she did. She was a very impressive woman. She became a very successful interior designer who was known for her minimalist aesthetic. She was famous for white on white.
In contrast with Welcome's collecting everything and filling every inch of his office and home with his collection.
Exactly. It's tempting to feel that might have been some kind of very successful rebellion against her former husband's acquisitiveness, definitely.
You report that she became a very, as you just said, very well known as an interior designer. She was quite well traveled and independent, even at age 22 before she married Sir Henry. But you also report that she met Somerset Maugham, had a child with him before the divorce was final with Sir Henry.
Yes. She did. She, as I said, her life was kind of sandwiched between these very famous men, her father, her first husband, Welcome. She then had an affair with Gordon Selfridge, another American twice her age, who was famous for establishing Selfridge's department store in London. And then she fell in love with Somerset Maugham, the very successful author and playwright. But it was not, again, unfortunately, it was not a happy relationship. She apparently really loved him, but he did not love her and was not interested. And so it was a very sad relationship, really. And yes, they did have a child before the divorce was finalized. In those days, it was very difficult to get a divorce. And one of the ways to achieve it was to prove infidelity. And so Welcome had resisted giving his wife, Siri, a divorce for many years, for about 6 years. But when he heard that she was living with Somerset Maugham and expecting a baby, he acquiesced and granted her a divorce, which was a very humiliating experience for all concerned, because divorce was not socially acceptable, really, at the time.
When you were writing this, I heard an interview earlier today on National Public Radio with Kitty Kelly, who you probably have never heard of, but she writes rather lurid biographies of famous people in this country, and they're all unauthorized biographies. And I suppose this biography of Sir Henry falls into that category, but not into that the same sort of thing.
It's not lurid, I don't
no,
think.
it's not lurid, but you're very, very straightforward and honest about people's foibles. And they're good, they're positive values, but also some of the things about them that were less than perfect. In contrast, one of the things you said about Sir Henry Walcombe was that he was often very generous to people he worked with. For example, you describe in the Sudan an archaeological dig where he hired 4,000 workers, and his rule was that anybody who applied to work for him must be hired, must be found some work to do and paid. He could afford it, but not everyone would have that rule.
Yeah, absolutely. He was very much really of the Victorian philanthropist mode, where he saw money in many ways as that if you earned a lot of money, it was your duty to do philanthropic good and to help other people less fortunate than yourself. But what came with that was a rather paternalistic and patronizing attitude to many of the people he helped. But you're absolutely right. He was interested in archaeology, and in about 1910, he started an annual excavation in Sudan. And it started with only a few people with the kind of homemade tools digging in the Nile basin. But over the next couple of years, it grew to hundreds and then thousands of workers, because Walcombe had a policy that anyone who wanted to work and wanted to work hard would get a job. And so it was really as much a philanthropic endeavor as it was an actual academic dig. Although he had great scholarly ambitions for the archaeology, when it came to the day-to-day job, his rule was a job must be found for whoever wanted to work. So he would have people policing the actual people who were excavating, feeding them, keeping their living quarters tidy. He just found jobs for anyone who wanted a job. So, of course, it attracted all sorts of people from the local community. But the other side of that was they weren't allowed to drink. They had to put their money into a savings bank that he'd established. They had to learn suitably, in quotes, civilized games like hockey and football. And so it came on...
Soccer, we call it here.
Soccer, yeah. So his generosity came with terms.
Fred, we're rapidly running out of time. Our 58 minutes are going quick. We're down to our last five or six, and we haven't even mentioned the Welcome Historical Medical Museum that lasted from 1913 to 1932, and then the museum that almost got started, or did it finally happen later after Sir Henry's death?
Yeah, Welcome opened a museum in 1913, and it was a very well-received museum. It was intended for academics and medics and scholars rather than the public, but all the journalists who visited were full of admiration for it, because it was very different, really, in that it was a medical museum, but it looked at medicine from all different cultures and all societies around the world. So it was within its own terms as being a research museum. It was very successful, and it was open until the early 1930s. And then they closed it, Welcome closed it. He was now in his late 70s, and he had plans for a much bigger, much grander museum. Most of his artifacts were in storage, had never seen the light of day, and he set his staff to unpacking things and organizing things behind the scenes in preparation for this final grand museum of the history of medicine. But unfortunately, he died just 4 years later when he was 83, and the museum was still closed, and his staff were still drowning in packing cases because he'd collected so many objects. And it really wasn't for many decades, really until the early 21st century, that his collection has found a place for itself in the public eye again, because it took his staff, he died in 1936, and it took his staff more than 50 years to sort through all the objects he'd acquired. And they gave things away, they sold things, and more than 100 museums now around the world have objects collected by Wellcome.
And there are Wellcome rooms or suites of rooms or buildings in various British museums.
Yes, there are. The Science Museum has a Wellcome wing and two Wellcome galleries, the Science Museum in London. The British Museum has a new Wellcome gallery. And just a few years ago, in 2006, the Wellcome Trust itself, their headquarters are in London, and they opened a new exhibition space called Wellcome Collection, and it has a permanent gallery which displays a tiny fraction of Wellcome's objects, but still, it's really the first time since the Wellcome's own museum closed in 1932. It's really the first time that his collection has had its own place in London, and it's a very successful new venture. Also, Wellcome's library. We shouldn't forget the Wellcome Library is the greatest, one of the greatest historical medical libraries in the world. It has more than 600,000 books and manuscripts relating to the history of medicine, and that the basis of that is Wellcome's own library. So definitely in the last few years, there's been a kind of resurgence of interest in Wellcome. He was an extraordinary character.
I'm afraid we'll have to let those words be our last ones from our guest, Fran Larson, L-A-R-S-O-N, Frances Larson, about her book, An Infinity of Things, How Sir Henry Wellcome Collected the World, published in 2009 by Oxford University Press. Her next book, projected, will come out in 2012, perhaps called Headhunters, about the Western culture's collections and of severed heads. I want to finish with one quote from the last chapter of her book, where she says, "Wellcome's collection was both a generous gesture and a selfish indulgence." Read her book, An Infinity of Things, to find out more details. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. I thank Fran for being awake so late in England to talk with us live tonight on Keeping the Faith. Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith will be a woman who's moved from fashion design to the pulpit. We'll be speaking with Joanne Fong, F-O-N-G, on December 19. Here on Keeping the Faith, the 29th archive program, Martha Nussbaum from the University of Chicago on the philosophy of education. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.